This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Okay, so thank you for joining us for this evening's Exploring Ethics program here at the Sanford Consortium Collaboratory. I'm Mike Kalichman. I'm director for the Center for Ethics in Science and Technology. I'm also director for ethics for the Clinical and Translational Research Institute at UC San Diego. The Ethics Center, which is running these programs, as you, I hope, all know by now, is interested not only in talking to the public about these issues, but talking with the public and having them be part of a conversation about the challenges in ethics that we need to face. Because we're interested in those ethical challenges, we want to look at a number of different questions, but one of the big questions is how should we best conduct the science that we are using in order to try and learn more things about the world around us. And part of that, of course, is in the arena of medical research or clinical research, which is a big part of the focus for this summer's series of programs. This series is titled Meeting the Challenges of Conflicts of Interest that occur in the context of academic and industry collaborations. The series has been made possible by the support of multiple groups, and those include Pfizer, Takeda, Johnson & Johnson, Abbott, as well as here in San Diego, Connect, UCSD, UCSD-TV, and the UCSD Clinical and Translational Research Institute. Those diverse groups help to underline that this is not a program that is set up for any one constituency or group. This is to hear from everybody to find the best possible solutions that work for all of us. To set the stage for tonight's particular program, I'm going to give you a little bit of background on the two previous programs, and we will then use that as a way to launch into the discussion this evening. So the first program on July 11th included Jeremy Barton of Pfizer and Gary Feierstein of UC San Diego. One of the themes of that discussion was it was very clear that everybody appreciated a tremendous value from industry working together with academia to come up with new developments. But we heard about skepticism regarding industry's motivations and what they are looking for. We heard skepticism about the potential that academics, when they receive industry funding, would be biased in what they do. We heard mutual concerns, concerns from both sides regarding the fair allocation of intellectual property rights. Our second program, August 8th, with Pat Grudy of Abbott Molecular and Richard Schwab of UCSD, spoke about other challenges in the context of personalized or precision medicine. Both of those speakers echoed the discussion from the previous forum, but they also highlighted that new targets for intervention are no longer going to be as easy as they had been in the past. As Schwab noted, it's not just one gene anymore. In thinking about the challenges, which we started to highlight in a big way in that meeting, we identified complementary roles and the reasons that industry and academia need to turn to each other. Academics were seen as having diverse medical and research specialists, firsthand experience and knowledge in the clinic, how best to improve technology into practice for clinical care and patient care, and having the biorepositories with patient samples that could be important for testing and developing new products and new approaches. On the other hand, industry has large libraries of compounds that could be tested or need to be tested. They have the expertise, the experience, and the funding to bring new drugs into the, and interventions into the market and therefore to patients. So if the ultimate goal is patient care, it was seen that we need both of those parts. And the question remains how to do that well. So we have the challenges I've already mentioned about the perceptions and the skepticism about the different players. But other challenges that were raised included the regulatory process that evolved at a time when things were different. And so there was concern that regulations now can be burdensome and slow down the process of trying to engage in these collaborations appropriately. There were also a lot of discussion about the differences in culture between academia and industry, where academics work with milestones that tend to be on the scale of 1 year, 2 years, 5 year grants, whereas industry often will be focused on a shorter term perspective, which has to do with quarterly reports and results. And finally, there was some concern about negative perceptions. Even if it's only a handful of people who have had serious missteps, those missteps find their way into the media and they taint the process for everyone. So there was concern that successful collaborations risk being hidden behind the media stories of the unsuccessful collaborations. So with all of those issues, what we're going to look at tonight in this third program in the series is to identify strategies that will solve or diminish the challenges to academic industry collaborations. Our overall question then is, how can we do better in structuring academic industry collaborations? Some other questions that I hope you will be thinking about and help us think about tonight are, which problems are most in need of solving? I've outlined some. You may think of others. Second, are there strategies that have already been used successfully that can help mitigate these problems? And if we could adopt those strategies more in a more widespread way, we might be better off. And finally, what new approaches that haven't been tried already might be useful here to improve what we're doing? So to address those questions tonight, we have two people who have very kindly offered to provide their time. The first on your far right is Thomas Kipps, an MD, PhD, professor of medicine at UCSD, also the Evelyn and Edwin Tash Chair in Cancer Research, and Deputy Director of Research Operations at the Moores Cancer Center. Thomas's research focuses on immunobiology and genetics of human B-cell malignancies, particularly chronic lymphocytic leukemia. He has consulted with many pharmaceutical firms, including Abbott Industries, Amgen, Genentech, Genzyme, Roche, Sanofi Aventis, and Theradex. And he has a leading role in the UCSD proposed Center for Innovative Therapeutics to house scientists from both UCSD and biotech companies. So he will have, I hope, a great deal to tell us tonight about what he's seen and what's worked and what hasn't worked and what we might do to improve those relationships between the academy and industry. And immediately on my left is Charles Burton, an MD who is widely respected in his field as a neurosurgical spine specialist, an ethicist and educator. He has over 4 decades of experience, which he did in parallel. It was actually over only 20 years, but he managed to get it into 40 years, in a neurosurgical spine rehabilitation, preventive care, and quality of life for patients with spinal disorders and disease. He's also chaired an FDA medical advisory panel. With his website, burtonreport.com, Dr. Burton is serving as a public watchdog for quality and cost-effective health care. He is, finally, the president-elect for the Association for Medical Ethics, and he's going to also help us tonight to think about some of the ways we might deal with these challenges. So the plan is that I've asked Drs. Kipps and Burton to each take a few minutes to highlight some of their experience, as well as their perspectives about the issues we're addressing today. Following their remarks, I'll engage them briefly to address a few specific questions, which will be followed by an opportunity for you to not only ask questions, but importantly, to offer your insights, your perspectives, your ideas about things that we might do. And I want to underline again, as I have in the past, that this is not a conversation only for the experts, and I put that in quote, because we are all experts of various types. We're experts because of our own particular knowledge and experience background. And with that in mind, we need to hear that. We need to have that feed into a collective discussion about the best way to address these challenges. So having said all of that, I think because we have spent so much time with a focus in the past programs beginning with looking at the advantages of industry and academic collaborations, maybe we can start with Dr. Burton to give us his perspectives and thoughts about some of the challenges he sees and what we might do with them.
Well, Mike, thank you for inviting me. First of all, I'm pleased to introduce one of the co-founders of the Association of Medical Ethics, Gemma Cunningham, who is kind of a corporate wunderkind and has been very instrumental in getting our organization going. I have taught neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins at Temple University. I was a Navy neurosurgeon. As you mentioned, I've been a medical device panel chairman. I've written standards. I've been involved in industry. I've been an industrial consultant. I've been involved in patenting a number of things. Probably the only one that you've ever heard of is the first fiber optic surgical headlight, which was patented in 1970. As a surgeon, my concerns and what I see is really focused more on excessive and unnecessary surgery. Actually, in the United States today, one of the greatest costs to the health system is excessive and unnecessary spine surgery. And unfortunately, that situation has not really changed very much. And mainly it hasn't changed because of the fact that the individuals who have been involved in it have really not been held accountable. And that's sad because it sets an example, particularly for young people going into medicine, young surgeons, young neurosurgeons, who think it's okay. It's okay to do that. I had the great opportunity of attending a think tank conference in Cambridge, Massachusetts this April. I was one of 150 invited participants to this conference, which was on avoiding avoidable care. And the organization of this was kind of unique because I found myself in the company of people such as the editor of JAMA, the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, the editor of the British Medical Journal, CEOs, including the CEO of Mass General Hospital. And to be in such incredibly honored company, as well as many clinicians, really opened up my eyes to a lot of what was going on as far as avoidable care in the United States. One of the things that was brought up at the conference, which everybody agreed to, is, and there was no question, everybody agreed our healthcare system is broken. A survey of all of the participants, unsurprisingly, brought up the fact that many of them felt that the influence of industry was an important adverse effect on healthcare in the United States today. What was amazing to me is that 94% of the people who were involved in that conference stated that they thought that that was a serious problem. A lot of time has been spent on what are the problems. The Association for Medical Ethics is working on some of the solutions, and we're trying to develop some things that we think are going to be important in the right direction for the right reasons, and we're involved in that now. So as an introductory statement, Mike, I'll turn it over and we can get into some of the specifics.
Okay, yeah, I'll follow up with some questions later, but yeah, so Tom.
I come from a slightly different field in medicine as well, in the area of hematology and oncology, and I tell you, the time today is a very exciting one because we are seeing the application of this huge amount of work that's been done on the human genome and on immunology and biochemistry, and bringing forth this watershed of new information and making available new therapies for patients with intractable diseases such as cancer. And there's no one that I know of that has a family member that has some problems with cancer. We all are concerned about the limitations of current therapies. So the idea of being able to envelop some of these new technologies into the treatment of cancer certainly caused a lot of excitement. I think that in academia, We are looking forward to the future. We're trying to develop tomorrow's therapies today in the clinic, which means that we cannot just exercise the failed paradigms of the past, but we have to reach to try and develop new protocols, testing new agents, new drugs, new applications of technology in ways that may make a difference and meaningful difference in the survival of our patients. So this is truly an exciting time. I think, though, in academia, as you've probably brought out with prior discussions, we have our limitations. We have big ideas. We have enthusiastic students and legions of scientists, and we're all very excited about our research activities. But there's also the business element that it takes to develop a product, to bring it to fruition, to pass through regulatory hurdles, and then to be able to market the drug so it becomes a product that can be used by more than people just at an academic center. This takes a tremendous amount of investment of time, energy, and talent. And so this has necessarily brought together industry with academia. And I don't think they can really exist very well independently. I do think there has to be a merger. But therein lies some of the issues that we're discussing today, the heart of the conflict of interest. And I don't think we can divorce the idea that there's going to be conflict of interest. I don't think we can live in a world where there is no conflict of interest. So the real question is, how do we manage conflict of interest? We have to understand that when a patient goes into a doctor's office, the patient usually is thinking that the doctor is going to be there solely for that person's interest, and that when the patient complains of symptoms or is diagnosed with the disease, the doctor is solely focused on the well-being of the patient and trying to prescribe a course of action that will benefit the patient, independent of other considerations which might taint that judgment or influence it in some way so as to put the patient at a disadvantage. This is really kind of a sacred trust between a physician and a patient, and it's something that we have to honor, and there's numerous safeguards that we have to employ in the conduct of our clinical trials. And so there are necessary regulations that we have in terms of how do we file, how do we disclose. I think what's very important is that to have the patient be fully aware of whatever activities we're engaged in that could allow us to perhaps influence our actions. It's not to say that they will be, but that there's a transparency so that they can recognize that there may be other considerations that might be at play. I do think disclosure helps, but it doesn't fully mitigate the problem. And I think it's also true that you can disclose things and do things in an unethical way with full disclosure. I think it's also very important that you stay true to the contract that you have within the physician-patient relationship, and you're able to be transparent about your conflicts, but to say with a full honesty that you are honoring that covenant between the patient and yourself as best you can. I think that this is something that can be done. We have review committees for this, ethical, bioethical committees to review, conflict of interest disclosures to file, and that does certainly help. I think that the other aspect is industry. I don't believe there's an industry, either biotech or major pharmaceutical industry, that can long survive with unethical behavior. I think the larger the company is, the more that they want to stay in business, the more they're going to have to adhere to a pattern of ethics. Why should that be important? Well, they can invest millions in research and even more in advertising and marketing, but if they got caught with an unethical behavior, it negates a lot of that investment and thus create a problem which can transcend their investment. So I do believe that companies that are successful in the long term will try to pursue a pattern of ethics in the conduct of trials. But make it clear, they have a clear mission, which is to try and evaluate the activity of the drug and to find the best possible application of that drug so they can bring it to the market and generate a business, which is to say that at the end of the day, they have to recover costs for research and development and marketing costs. And in that, because of that nature, of that interest, they will have to put that as a sole focused activity. But I've had experience of a number of pharmaceutical companies. I can tell you this, that within every large company, there are a series of individuals who are committed, who may have an idealistic view, who are committed to certain diseases, what diseases, what things we choose to work on is a very personal and subjective assessment. And some companies refuse to get involved with diseases which are representing with only a small number of patients. They're called orphan diseases because there's not a large enough market share. Whereas other companies are willing to make an investment. Why? Not just because of the profit motive, because they can do the market analysis as well as anybody else, but because they're wanting to, in their own lives, make a difference. And I do think it's very important that we tap into that spirit within the company. First, the long-term interest of the company to practice ethical standards, to recognize that full disclosure is important, to try to do things in the appropriate way, to realize that if they are not transparent in their activities or to withhold information, they can get in serious trouble that can end up ruining their business. The second thing is to how do you inspire the people to work on projects that bring out more than just what you can pay an individual for. Now, trying to merge these things between the industry and academia is no small feat, and that's something we hope to do within the Center for Novel Therapeutics, which is to say, how do we get some of the ideas that are being born in the laboratory and to take them and to have them establish roots, to try and test them early on, and perhaps to develop them to the sufficient extent to be able to introduce them into the clinic. This takes a tremendous amount of coordination, disparate talents, and activities. And how do we maintain this with highest ethical standards of transparency and full disclosure? That's, again, no easy task. But I do think it not being easy is not an excuse not to do it. I don't think we can put our heads in the sand and say we're not going to have any conflict of interest because the loss would be something that would be considered unethical, namely to deprive people of intractable diseases, those necessary treatments that could mean the difference between life and death. So we have to go about this business. We have to do it in a way that when someone views it from the long term, I think they will be able to recognize that we were doing it for the right reasons. I like to tell people that what we have in terms of correspondence with companies, our activities, how would you like to have this correspondence or what have you, an email published on the front page of the New York Times? And it gives you some pause. Would you like to have this fully disclosed to everyone? And what would the consequences of that be? And if they're not prepared to say they would be okay with that, then there may be some reservations that we may need to think about in terms of how do we address some of the conflicts that are not coming to full disclosure, even among ourselves or to ourselves. That's a very important question to ask.
Good, thanks. So out of just this brief introduction to the three of you, there are at least a dozen questions that I would like to go through, but I won't go through all of those. But I mean, I think the very first one I want to pick up on your description of a conflict of interest and how we all have them. And I would like both of you to react to something we discuss in our research ethics courses at UCSD, and that's we try and answer the question, is a conflict of interest in itself bad? And I think I've heard your answer, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you'd say, no, the conflict of interest isn't bad in itself.
I think we all have conflicts. And I think to not recognize that is to be ignorant. I think there are conflicts in everything that we do. And I think we have to be aware of what our motives are. What is our driving facets? Why are we doing what we do? What gets us out of bed in the morning? Why do we go to the work that we have? There are some subjective reasons for that. It's not purely objective. And I think we have, you know, to understand some of the motivating facets because some of these may provide an incentive which conflicts with another stated incentive that is assumed by the roles that we play, either in academia, as a professor, or as a doctor in a patient-client relationship, or in a person in industry. I think that's very important. And so I don't think conflict of interest is bad. I do think what we need to do is to mitigate the conflict of interest from allowing us to do things that would be viewed objectively as resulting in lack of full transparency or in doing things which breach the confidence in the position that we hold with others that we're going to act in a certain way, be it a newscaster, a politician, a doctor, or what have you. We can see what's happening in politics at Democratic conventions tonight. But in politics or in news commentators, it's becoming more apparent that there may not be full disclosure of what opinions may be voiced. And so there's a growing cynicism about the media and about political activity in general. This is not a very good thing for our country because in a country such as ours, we have to encourage debate, and we have to assume that when the debate is housed and interpreted, that it's being interpreted with objectivity and not tainted by some other special interest. So it does poison the debate. It poisons our ability to get things done, and it will poison our ability to bring these new therapies to the patient if we are not able to address this question successfully. Break down trust. If patients were fearful that the doctors would put the interest of a company or some profit above the relationship with the patient, would that patient wish to go into any clinical trial? I would put forward no. And as a consequence, without clinical trials, there would be no progress. And as a consequence, we'd be mired to being repeating what has been done in the past. In oncology, that's not a very good solution.
We've touched on a number of things that I think we'll probably come back to, some of those about trust and the question of bias and what that might do because of the conflict of interest. But I think the most important thing is that first question, you would say that conflict of interest is not in itself bad. It's, in a sense, how we deal with it. And I don't know, do you want to react to that, Chuck?
As long as you have human beings, you're going to have conflicts of interest. Mm-hmm. I'm from Minnesota, and I don't know if you remember Charles Mayo, but Charles Mayo said, the interest of the patient should always come first. And I think a lot of people have kind of forgotten about that. I've been very much involved in industry, medical devices. I've been a consultant. I have many patents. I've licensed them. I've been a legitimate consultant. My relationships with licensing and sale of patents has been legitimate. It's the sham consulting, the sham patents, the sham activities, the illegal activities that we're concerned about. Why are we concerned about them? Besides the fact that it's not good ethic. Well, what does it breed? It breeds a lot of contempt. It breeds flawed science, fabricated science, even examples of human experimentation that would not pass the Nuremberg standards. And this is not in cases where this has occurred. People have not been held accountable for this. So bad behavior doesn't change unless you're held accountable for bad behavior. So how can organizations do things? Well, the Association for Medical Ethics has worked on disclosure of conflicts of interest. A lot of academic institutions have changed and improved their conflict of interest requirements, how much are you paid by industry, what have you. Please understand something. As president-elect of the organization, I am absolutely delighted to have people work with industry. I agree with you. Only if we work with industry, use our expertise in drugs, devices, other areas, are we going to move ahead. But it has to be legitimate. It has to be ethical. We promote people doing that. We don't care how much a physician earns as a consultant for industry. We don't care how much a surgeon who develops a device gets for that, as long as it's legitimate. And the problem is that from where we sit and what we've seen, so much of this has been under the table, and it has not been an even playing field. So how do you make it an even playing field? Well, one of the things our organization is in the process of doing is, and some of the healthcare organizations actually came to us and said, well, gee, you know, why don't you have people who are going to be providers to our organization be members of the Association for Medical Ethics? Because to be a member, you have to say that you have only legitimate consulting interests, what have you. Real simple. And this is something that's real interesting because it's very simple to do. It's a concept. I'm talking to some of the specialty boards. Why don't you require the members of your organization to be members of AME? It doesn't cost anything. All you're doing is representing the fact that what you're doing is legitimate. And we don't care how much money you make at that. As a matter of fact, if you make a lot of money and it's legitimate, that's great because it means that it has applicability and it's going somewhere. So there are no easy answers, but we're working to try and bring about some changes that make a difference now. We've all seen what the problems are. We really need to spend more time in talking about solutions. That makes sense, I think.
And we will be talking about some of that tonight. I think one question that comes to my mind is that you use two terms. One is sham, and the other is legitimate. And I think I'm not quite sure what qualifies in each case. I suspect that you would find very few people who would say, what I'm doing is illegitimate, no matter how bad it is. So what are the criteria for legitimate here? That
fraudulent. Doesn't pass the smell test. Illegal.
So looking from the outside, if somebody comes to you and says, what I'm doing is legitimate, how would you know that it's legitimate other than that they've said that it's legitimate? I'm just interested in how this plays out with AME.
Well, disclosure. The Physicians Payment Sunshine Act, which will come in effect the first of next year, is going to require medical device companies to simply put out there who they're paying and what they're paying them for. Based on my personal experience over many years, when you lift up the rock and you let in some sunshine, things change for the better dramatically in a very short period of time. And these are activities that are not desired to be known to patients, the public, and others. Real simple.
So the key to legitimate in this case is disclosure and openness about what you're doing.
Telling it like it is, sunshine. Mm-hmm. Let the sunshine in. And let the chips fall where they may.
Yeah, and so now there's a couple of dichotomies that I want to address. And the first one is the dichotomy between different kinds of inappropriate behavior or bias. So I think both of you have touched a lot on the question of somebody doing something that any intelligent observer would say, this is wrong, this is fraudulent, this is not in a patient's interest, it's in your interest alone, where it's simply bad. But there are also cases of unconscious bias, the willingness to do something that you don't really recognize as wrong. You see something the way you want to. And when you're in the clinical setting, it may be different than the research setting. So we might want to, that's the other dichotomy, clinical versus research. But I'm wondering if each of you could comment briefly on your worry about the unconscious bias, whether that's as bad or not as bad. It exists. For what we're worried about,
I think we may live in different worlds. I mean, as a surgeon, I think my world's different than yours is. I mean, there are surgical guidelines. There are orthopedic and neurosurgical guidelines. I mean, one guideline is you don't do multi-level fusion on someone as primary treatment for low back pain if they have multi-level disc degeneration. Now, that seems pretty straightforward, but yet there's tremendous transgression on that. And it isn't yesterday, it's today, and it'll be next week. Tom?
I think that to be a physician is to be human and caring for another human being. And oftentimes what there can be problems and bias in terms of assuming that that caring relationship is always going to translate into anything that is done as being for the patient's benefit. That's a bias that's, I think, held by a number of physicians. I remember when I was in my training, one of our chair of medicine was stating, well, when a patient is going to say going badly after therapy, it's always assumed that was despite our best efforts. In other words, there's less assumption that our intervention may be actually causing some problems with the patient. I've always taken that to heart because I do see that physicians and the decisions we make, the tools that we have, either surgery or medicines, can sometimes evoke unintended consequences. And if it's not assumed or what have you that this may be iatrogenic, then we can sometimes go down a path where the patient may get worse and not get better because that intervention is not stopped. That's a very important spirit of objectivity that is actually more pervasive in the clinical practice because of the fact that there is this caring relationship between a patient and a physician. I was struck by it in medical school. I went through my courses, and at the end I was finishing up, and they said, well, you have to take one more course. And I said, well, what was that? And it was the history of medicine. And I said, this is kind of funny. I feel like I'm going back to college. And it turned out to be the most important course I took in medicine. And what it did was we went back and we looked at how medicine was practiced from antiquity through the Dark Age, Age of Galen and the Vesalius and the Anatomica, and up into even the modern times when the Age of Reason brought forward statistical reasoning. And before, there was the absolute, you know, that we did not really have enough empiricism in the world to be able to refute absolute knowledge. And so there was no statistics. There was no clinical trials in the Middle Ages until the Age of Enlightenment. And there's always these assumptions about the activities that we did for our patients having benefit. And sometimes it's laughable now. And I remember this one early attempt to do a clinical trial in New England where the person was chided by the Boston Medical Society because of an unethical clinical trial that he was proposing. And that was to study kids with diphtheria. And to do the trial, he had to propose an arm of the kids that would be denied the benefit of leeches for their therapy. And he was censured for this as being unethical because the assumption was that medical intervention of the day was so important that to deny a patient of this is going to be unethical. So here's where we come into the conundrum of ethics, group ethics as well as individualized ethics. And that sort of behavior, I think it's always very important. In academia, I think we have it more so, and I wish we could emphasize it more in medicine, is always to challenge the notion that when you intervene in somebody's life, that you are actually affecting a positive benefit. It certainly made me more nihilistic at times in proposing treatments, and particularly in areas such as the treatment of patients with cancer. I do think we have to be introspective about it and challenge ourselves because there's this conflict of our own interest to be the good guy, the guy that's going to intervene and make things better. Why do you become a doctor? You want to make patients better. And that interest to make patients better can conflict with your interest of trying to be objective in understanding what you're doing as being a benefit or not.
You know, the history of medicine and medicine is a tough act. The beauty of medicine is it doesn't change quickly. The bane of medicine is it doesn't change quickly. How long did it take Semmelweis to convince his associates to wash their hands between the delivery room and the autopsy room? One of my heroes is William of Ockham, 14th century. William of Ockham's razor. It is needless to do more and less will suffice. As a surgeon, let me just say, I believe that. I don't see a lot of my, or many of my associates who believe that because they have a passion for doing surgery. And I'm sure that many of them feel that the surgical answer is the right answer for their patients, and they may truly believe that. It's important to have a higher order of influence on some of this. Very simply. Sunshine. I think that's a great step forward. Disclosure. Tell it like it is. William of Ockham's razor. It is needless to do more when less will suffice. William is his brother. Interest of the patient should come first. And, of course, Hippocrates. So, you know, we have some guidelines that are really important guidelines. One of my favorite bits with Steve Martin is when he was arrested for kidnapping. And what was his defense? He said, "I forgot. I forgot that kidnapping was against the law." Okay, I think there are people out there practicing medicine who forget what ethics are. There are many students here. Don't let yourself and others forget what ethics are.
So I hope that's, actually we're going to get to questions in just a moment. I want to finish up one last bit here and then ask the audience, and I encourage all of you to participate with questions. So this has been helpful, and just to underline though that we've seen a little bit of a distinction between the clinical setting and the research setting in certain respects. The clinical setting, you're there for the individual patient, there are guidelines, and for the most part the concept of unconscious bias or mistakes may be less but not absent than in the research setting, where it could be a pretty significant factor. But I think I'm hearing from both of you that idea of disclosure and transparency would be helpful in both cases to decrease the risk of that happening.
It always scares me quite a bit, because we always have, and I manage a laboratory, and I think that we challenge our students and our fellows and other members of the laboratory to try and do their best, work hard to test hypotheses by setting up the experiments and coming back with the data that we can analyze and try to make discoveries. I always have to emphasize that a discovery is not finding what you expect to find, but finding the unexpected, which means that if you lay out a series of experiments to prove what you think should be true, then that's really not going to get you into a new discovery. You have to be able to be open-minded to your observations and have appropriate controls. And it's important to, you know, when you make a discovery, to validate it. And sometimes the thrill of discovery could be intoxicating, and the validation steps may indicate that the discovery is not as exciting as it was anticipated. That could be a disappointment and a challenge. But I have to keep emphasizing that it's more important to be correct, because there's no significant research that's not going to be attempted to be reproduced. And there's a kind of a psychosis that goes into fabricating research data and to make a difference. If you want to make an impact, you have to be able to be correct, because if it can't be reproduced, then the whole thing becomes into a question, and it taints the overall impact of the research activity.
He's right. But, you know, we have some legacies. Walter Reed Army Hospital was named after Dr. Walter Reed, and he is known for his work on yellow fever and his research on yellow fever. And he and his associates used themselves as guinea pigs. And some of them died. That's an ethic. Well, I'm not saying that you should, you know, use yourself as guinea pigs, but that's part of the ethic of our profession. Informed consent is key. Have we done things in the past that we're not proud of? Yeah, infecting people with syphilis, injecting hospitalized patients with plutonium and not telling them, things like that. Well, we know that's wrong. That isn't what we're all about. I think inherently, we know what the legacy and the history of medicine is. Sometimes we just have to be reminded about it. A lot of people have gone before us and done some wonderful things, so we can sit here tonight and talk about this. And I'm sure 100 years from now, looking back on a lot of what we do today, they're going to say, we're barbaric. Chemotherapy, that's barbaric, man. I mean, that's no question about that.
Hopefully not 100 years from now.
Hopefully.
So, but in a moment, I would like people to join us for questions. But and specifically to try and look as much as we can about what the challenges are that we do want to face and how we might best deal with them. And some of the challenges we've talked about before, I'm just interested in your quick reactions to this. So in terms of regulations that are now in place, are they a hurdle to effective academic industry collaborations? And this might be more of a question for Tom, who's, I think, in the midst of dealing with those questions than Chuck. But Chuck, you can answer too. But.
I think that the regulations, if they're administered in a objective way, which also doesn't have a bias, and I have seen this having served on institutional review boards and some other committees where there may be some faculty members who have never really interfaced with academia and for reasons that may not be clear have a very dim view of this and wish to profess a very monastic type of lifestyle that is an unencumbered by the vulgarities of the real universe that surrounds the university, that we are a monastery university and we will be pious and will not be tainted by the conflicts that surround us. And so if the regulations are introduced through that prism, they can sometimes be, in a sense, punitive before they have a chance to really be applied. And in a sense, that could create a type of conflict between the investigator and one's own institution, which doesn't need to be. And I think that that's very important. So the objectivity in which these regulations are applied, I think, are important. The transparency, not only in terms of what we disclose, but the disclosure of what is the nature and need for these regulations can help to mitigate some of the distrust that might compromise the effectiveness of this regulation. Because I don't think that ultra regulations are going to get you there, but common sense things that leads one to define behaviors that are ethical, which defines transparency, which is part of disclosure, and as well as honesty. That's what you're talking about. Integrity, ethics comes from the key phrase of, I think, being honest with oneself and the people around you so that there's not a misrepresentation of what you're trying to achieve. And I think the university can bring out that in its faculty and needs to do so.
If you're asking, are we over-regulated? My opinion is yes, we are very over-regulated. Do you need regulations? Absolutely yes. You need regulations. They're important. I testified before the Congress for the Medical Device Amendments of 1976. That's how far I go back. I don't think the FDA has ever understood what the Congress of the United States wanted them to do. They wanted to approve safety and efficacy of medical devices and follow those medical devices. They also wanted the FDA to promote those devices, sometimes orphan drugs, orphan devices, that were not commercially viable, that were in the public interest. They've never done that.
Well, fortunately, none of our congressmen have conflict of interest.
Well, let me just say this to you. I'm part of a technology consortium that just licensed some very exciting, I think, medical technology for products, and we wouldn't think of introducing it in the United States. We introduced it to a group in Israel.
My question focuses on large randomized controlled trials, you know, which are usually funded by the pharmaceutical company that is trying to get that product on the market. And especially the inclusion and exclusion criteria that are used in those trials are then usually once the drug gets on the market, these inclusion exclusion criteria are nowhere to be seen, and the drugs are used on a common population. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on that issue, if there should be an institute maybe besides the pharmaceutical industry that does these trials with maybe a broader range of patients to make it safer, just talking about Vioxx, for example, or other huge drugs that had to be withdrawn. And I think, I don't know how to address that.
You know, you're talking about off-label use of drugs and devices. And in many areas, the greatest use of drugs and devices is off-label. And sometimes the great majority of use is off-label. So the question of the ethics of off-label use and the control of off-label use is a whole symposium in and of itself.
It is, but I think ironically, I think she's talking about even more. If I understood correctly, are you saying that when a trial is conducted, there are inclusion and exclusion?
I could just tell one trial real fast just to understand my point. So heart failure trial, so patients taking statins that are having heart failure, for example. There were two large trials done a couple of years ago, but patients were excluded that had arrhythmias. So, which, fair enough, it was an exclusion criteria. But in cardiology, you very rarely see a patient that has heart failure that does not have an arrhythmia. So this just an example. I don't know, there might be many others. So,
yeah, but, and then when the drug is approved...
Exactly, when the drug is approved,
there's
it's
no
a guideline
from, sorry, with arrhythmias,
based on the trial that it didn't hurt, or there was no benefit in this trial, but it's still used, you know, but the patients were excluded. So I don't know, it's just, for me, it's an ethical issue. As a physician.
Right,
so that's why I'm asking
the question.
That's
a very good point.
I think that there are numerous examples of that, and I do think that oftentimes when we think about the complexities, it relates into oncology, where a number of participants on clinical trials oftentimes may be of younger age, and their ability to tolerate some therapies which might be more toxic in older individuals, yet when it becomes approved, it may be equally applied, and therefore also the problem that often these therapies are given in the context of other comorbidities and taking other medications, as you point out with arrhythmias, it becomes a very complex situation. And I do think that therein lies some of the need for better medical education on the part of not only the patients, but also physicians.
But I think it's driven by the companies, you know, that of course they want to do a trial which is safe, you know, to not hurt people. But then there's no intention. I'm not saying that there's an intention with it. But then when it's used on a broad population, it's forgotten that that was not an arm in the study. You know,
I think that's correct. I do think that there are examples, though, when that happens, where it actually comes back to harm the company and harm the drug that they are trying to market if they are not able to market it in the appropriate way. And I'll give you an example of one product that was approved and had very good activity, and yet its activity was perhaps defined in a small segment of the population in which it was intended for, and it was heavily marketed for the entire population, wherein the people who may not have benefited as well from the drug had complications. And so the drug itself became known as one that was associated with those complications. And so it fell out of favor even for that segment of the population that could benefit from the drug. And as a consequence, the drug was actually dropped, and I think it's no longer being used for that indication. So this happens both ways. I do think that it's very important when companies want to market their drugs to understand what the risk-benefit ratios are and to try and market it with a clear understanding that they should convey those to the physicians who are practicing the treatment.
Yeah, but the problem is you have a patient on 15 medications. How would you ever know which drug was the problem in the end? You know,
I think that's
so
a very big problem.
This is for me like an ethical dilemma, kind of.
Yeah, I mean this is actually a beautiful example of the ethical challenge in this whole setting, that there is no way, conceivably, that you could test for every possibility clinically. We have to take our best shot, and you end up having a very sterile clinical trial, sterile in the sense that it's very focused and very limited. And ultimately, you then have to have judgment and knowledge and understanding on the part of the physician who's going to be treating patients, not to assume that just because the drug was approved, that it's therefore going to make everybody better and be the best thing for them. And that connection is probably, that becomes a medical education issue, I presume. First, how do we teach people in medical school?
But
and
I think the pharmaceutical companies do a very good job in selling their drugs, you know, and leaving pamphlets at their offices. And this is the kind of information or training that a lot of physicians are getting. And I don't know, I just wanted to raise that maybe...
Your questions are marvelous. Mm-hmm. Drug overuse and off-label. I mean, two extremely important issues in healthcare today. I don't think we're going to solve it tonight, though.
And topics that we should have for future forums. So addition, over here.
Hi, I wanted to ask kind of a two-part question. I've worked in clinical trials for motion preservation for disc replacement at single level in the spine. And I'm curious to know Dr. Burton's thoughts on artificial joints at one level. And then if you could elaborate on your comment regarding spine surgery being one of the most highest categories of unnecessary surgery, whether that's for lack of conservative treatment or the multi-level DDD that you mentioned.
It's actually one of the highest loss leaders in a healthcare system as far as excessive and unnecessary procedures. Consumers Reports even has identified that. What I was saying in regard to the issue, one of the key abuses is multi-level fusion as a treatment for low back pain in patients with degenerative disc disease. And there is universal agreement in orthopedics and in neurosurgery that those patients should be treated non-surgically. So there are guidelines. I mean, professional organizations are working to create guidelines. There do exist in some areas specific guidelines. Guidelines regarding discography. Discography has been essentially shown to be totally unreliable as a means of determining who is a surgical candidate, particularly for fusion. But yet, I see patients who are having three-level fusions for back pain, patients who are having discography on a continuing basis. And that is a very disturbing, continuing line of abuse where it's pretty clear-cut that it is. Many of these issues that we've discussed tonight are not clear-cut. But there are some that are. And off-label use, bone morphogenic protein. That is a whole story in regard to itself. But what's better than bone morphogenic protein? Human bone marrow. Bone morphogenic protein costs $5,000 for a vial. Bone marrow contains bone morphogenic protein and stem cells, and it's free. But no one knows about it because millions of dollars weren't spent marketing human bone marrow for surgical use. Millions of dollars were spent in marketing bone morphogenic protein too, and now we're dealing with the realization that there were serious problems with its use over the past 10 years that weren't recognized or weren't identified because all of the papers that were published initially were published by people who were consultants for the company that was selling it and marketing it, and the physicians were out there marketing it. And it was essentially all off-label on top of that. So I think that one of the things that we've done tonight is promoted awareness. We don't have answers to a lot of these tough questions. But by the same token, I think this is food for thought for all of us. And I think things are heading in a healthy direction. Maybe not at the FDA, but in other areas.
Thanks. So we're actually running up against 7 o'clock. So and your last comment was a good one. I think we did identify a number of problems and hear some challenges that we don't yet have solutions to. But we also heard a pretty good list of things, which I'll try and summarize with the help of Dennis Ryan from Pfizer, who's been helping to take notes for us tonight. Try and summarize by way of a summary of what we got out of the entire series for ideas of things that might help with dealing with some of these challenges. So at this point, before finally closing the program, I want to thank Drs. Kipps and Burton very much for their participation tonight and the audience as well for your willingness to ask questions and participate in the discussion. So everybody, a round of applause.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.